From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour goes back to the fall of 1963. Variety show host Ed Sullivan and his wife were, at least the legend says, at a London airport. And it was an unusually busy day at this airport, the legend says, with the Prime Minister due to fly out and contestants for the Miss World contest arriving. More than 1,000 people, many of them teenagers, lined the rooftop gardens of the Queen's building, and others congregated on the ground. Sullivan asking, "What's all the commotion about?" He was informed it was for the Beatles, who were returning from a tour in Sweden. Well, the legend says he replied, "Who the hell are the Beatles?" And they say that Sullivan decided then, right there, he wanted this British group on the show. Do we believe it? What's the true story of how this all happened? It's probably a little murkier than that. At some point in the fall, agents were talking and they decided the Beatles would come to America. Ed Sullivan was certainly interested. He booked them to appear in February. Before Christmas, several American radio stations broke the rules and started airing the song She Loves You. It was an instant hit, and it forced the Beatles' label to move up the release date. Beatlemania was building. Even CBS's Walter Cronkite aired a story on the band, and so by the time that the Beatles arrived for the Ed Sullivan Show, anticipation was almost out of control. More than 73 million Americans tuned in to their first live American appearance on February 9, 1964. For comparison, tomorrow night, President Obama gives the State of the Union. They expect an audience of about 11 million. So with the 50th anniversary of that first Sullivan Show coming up, the University of Rochester is celebrating and educating. Professor John Kovach is here, and we're taking your calls and recollections for the hour. Professor Kovach is the director for the Institute for Popular Music. Welcome.
Hey, Evan. Good to see you.
All right. Well, before we reveal everything that the university has coming up, and before we start debunking or confirming some of what we just heard, what I'd like to do is get to our first sound cut, because when you hear the reaction of this audience, it reminds you that, yeah, Justin Bieber wasn't the first to have teenage girls fawning over him. This is the first time the Beatles appeared live with Ed Sullivan. Let's listen.
And now, here he is, Ed Sullivan.
Thank you very much. Now, yesterday and today, our theater's been jammed with newspapermen and hundreds of photographers from all over the nation, and these veterans agree with me that the city never has witnessed the excitement stirred by these youngsters from Liverpool who call themselves the Beatles. Now, tonight, you're going to twice be entertained by them, right now and again in the second half of our show. Ladies and gentlemen, the Beatles!
Close your eyes and I'll kiss you.
All right, so we're hearing those screams. Professor, those girls were crazy for them. Even that was their first live appearance, and that legend was already there, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's hard not to smile as you listen to that, especially if you're of a certain age. You can remember all of that happening. You know, the excitement around the Beatles, a lot of people try to explain why it happened. But, you know, it was not like it was the first time in popular music that a popular singer or artist had girls screaming over them. I mean, the similar kind of thing happened with Elvis Presley. It was less of a developed media environment when it happened. And even Frank Sinatra had the Bobby Soxers sort of all over him, swooning back in the 40s. So this phenomenon of screaming girls, not exactly new. And in fact, during the British invasion, they weren't the only band to have screaming girls. In fact, they weren't the only, the British weren't the only ones. The Beach Boys had screaming girls. But still, that's what we always associate. It was maybe more intense and bigger with the Beatles. And so when you hear those screams, it almost goes with the recording, doesn't it?
It does. It drowns out Sullivan. I think he says the Beatles, and what did he say? Let's bring them on, but you can't even hear it after that. Here's what you want to do for the hour. 263-WXXI, 263-9994. We'd love to get your recollections if you happen to watch that show, and if you're too young to have watched that show, like your host. What are your thoughts on the Beatles and their legacy? Because I think about those songs that they performed then, and they're fun poppy songs, but when I think about what made the Beatles great, it was the diversity of music that they brought later.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, I mean, one of the Beatles' great, couple of great accomplishments. The first one is the 1963 in the UK. They were the band that led the beat music revolution there that really, for the first time, put British artists in a situation where they thought they were, where they and their fans felt like they were maybe as good or perhaps even better than American artists. Up to that point, everything in Britain was either American artists on the charts or British artists trying to be like American artists on the charts. With the Beatles, it changed the British music industry. Had they never broken the United States, they still would have been important for having done that. And then, of course, their fame in 1964 being the first British group to really have sustained success in America the way that they did. But then the third one that people, which you're referring to, which people often overlook, is the fact that their careers outlived the fad that brought them to fame. You know, so they were flavor of the month, and in many ways people were treating them just like the new big thing, the hula hoop, the slinky, the mood ring, the pet rock, whatever. But because of what they were able to do with their music, they were able to outlive that and continue to develop. I mean, a lot of groups didn't. How much these days do we hear about Jerry and the Pacemakers or the Dave Clark Five or Billy J. Kramer or groups like that? If you're someone like me that lives in this world and talks about it all the time, you do. But really, the Beatles continued into 1966, 67 after Sgt. Pepper. It was almost like a different band.
Yeah,
and then of course since they broke up in 1970, they've always been a presence in pop music. Sometimes more, sometimes less. That's, you know, remember back in the 80s, Beatles music was not something you heard all the time the way you hear it now. I mean, they have had their ebb and flow career wise. They're currently having a tremendous resurgence in interest has been going on.
And speaking of, let me add, and if you're listening to the program now, you're hearing the voice of Professor John Kovach, who is the director of the Institute for Popular Music, on February 9th at 8 p.m. on the 50th anniversary of the Beatles' first appearance on the Ed Sullivan Show. The U of R is launching a 6-week free online Beatles course. And how many people have signed up already?
Well, I think this morning we're up to 27,000 worldwide who have enrolled. I've done a couple of other courses for the name of this site is Coursera. And if you don't know about Coursera, it's a place where people can take courses absolutely free of charge. The videos are all there for you to stream, and there are quizzes and things you can take, and you even get a certificate at the end if you pass all the quizzes and do pretty well. I taught my history of rock there in two parts, and the overall enrollment for history of rock, we've done it a couple of times since May, has been over 100,000
people. That is remarkable. 70%
of which are outside the United States. I'm very big in Brazil.
It's true, isn't it?
No, you think I'm joking, but we've sort of tried to work all this out, of course. So now the Beatles is really the third one that I've done. And so I've got a lot of my alumni from those previous two times through History of Rock who are enrolled. And the Coursera people will very soon start, as we get closer to the start date, February 9th, start promoting it through their site. So I wouldn't be surprised to see the enrollment hit about 40,000. Maybe raw enrollments might go to like 55,000.
That's really amazing.
It's amazing. And, you know, it's great because the university, all universities should spend more time reaching out outside their walls and sort of letting people know all the fantastic things that go on inside the university that are usually sort of experienced only by people who are inside the university community. So it's fantastic to be able to share that, not just with anybody who wants to sign up, but with people worldwide. It's a fantastic opportunity for us.
How do you sign up if our listeners want to?
Well, if they want to go to Coursera.org and just put the search in the search window, just put Beatles.
Can you spell Coursera?
It's a Coursera.org. Or you can just put Coursera into your search window on Google or Bing or whatever you use, and it'll all pop up.
Yeah, it's great stuff. But before we get to some more of the sound cuts, because we've got other little goodies planned this hour that we're going to be getting Professor Kovach's take, let's get to Deanne in Rochester. She is on with Professor John Kovach. Go ahead, Deanne.
Hi, Evan. I just wanted to say that I'm of the generation of those screaming girls, although I wasn't screaming, but back then I was in love with George Harrison. But I must say that now that I've gone through into my 50s and 60s, my real heart belongs to John Lennon, and I think sometimes it takes maturing for a person to realize what the words are behind the music.
Yeah.
And I did want to just say that I went, when I was young, live to Toronto to see the Rolling Stones, the other great famous group, and they had this guy on ahead of them that nobody knew, who I thought, wow, I really like this guy better, and it was Stevie Wonder.
Wow. Wow. That's a tremendous experience, too. Now, Dan, can I ask you, because, again, this is it predates me a little bit. Is the Ed Sullivan Show appearance for you and your friends and your generation, is this one of those you remember where you were when sort of situations?
Well, I mean, we watched it like we watched Disney World Sunday night. You know, we could eat on TV trays in the living room. But for me, the John F. Kennedy assassination, that's where you remembered where you were.
Yeah.
Thank you, Evan. You're doing a great job.
Well, thanks for the call. Great stuff. And way ahead of the curve with Stevie Wonder. But, Professor, is this, when you talk to people who witnessed it and were, like Dan said, maybe the screaming girls themselves or maybe not, do most people who were alive then seem to have a recollection of...
Well, people who saw the Beatles on Ed Sullivan certainly remember that, you know, because it was more than just a television event. It was what we used to call water cooler moments back in the days when everybody watched the same thing on TV at the same time and not on demand or on Netflix or something like that. But, you know, everybody was talking about it on the way leading up to it. Everybody was talking about it on the way after. So that has a way of fixing something in your mind, even if it has no real personal impact on you. I mean, how many people can think of where they are when they first heard about 9/11, even if they didn't know anybody who was involved in any part of it? Still, the fact that it made such a big noise in our culture, and of course such a tragic event, really causes people to kind of remember how it came down. And I think it's that way with the Beatles on Ed Sullivan. For me, the big memory of 1964 regarding the Beatles was my grandmother, I was 5 years old, taking me to see A Hard Day's Night. I grew up in suburban Detroit, in a suburban Detroit theater. And so we go in there, here's my grandmother bringing this 5-year-old kid in a place filled with teenage fans. They're weren't any other 5-year-olds there, I don't think. And the minute the lights went down and the movie came on, the girls started screaming and didn't stop screaming and yelling. And they're screaming at a film. There were no actual musicians in attendance.
You probably wanted to listen to what was being...
Well, I remember saying to my grandmother, can you ask him to sit down? I can't see. You know. So a couple of weeks later, after things had settled down a little bit, she took me back and I got to see the movie all the way through. But all I could remember was the intensity of the reaction. And this was happening, you know, probably 5 times a day at this particular theater in Detroit and other theaters around Detroit and all across the country, all around the world, this kind of intensity. And, you know, I guess in many ways I could say it kind of changed my life. I ended up, you know, spending my life as a career in music. I can remember when we used to get those records. What does a 5-year-old do when they're excited about music? Well, what we did is we put the record on one of those old record players with a nickel tape to the tone arm, and we played the record, and we jumped on the bed and sang. You know, you kids, stop jumping on the bed and listen to those Beatles records. You're going to break your head open or something. But anyway, that's what I did. And it was just a kind of an unbridled excitement.
263-WXXI, 263-9994. We'd like to hear more of your recollections and thoughts about not only the Sullivan Show experience, but also just the Beatles themselves, because Professor Kovach is, don't you wish you were taking a class from a guy like, I wish all of my professors were like Professor Kovach. It's great stuff. Now, in a second, he's going to talk about the Beatles' first visit, myths versus facts. But before that, I do want to extend the point you were just making, which is, you know, this was at a time when not a lot of television stations. You didn't have YouTube. You didn't have internet. And so the buildup for a television experience like that was enormous. And I don't think it's too far to say we'll never see it quite like that again with any other supergroup, because by the time they would arrive on U.S. soils, you would have heard their music for many, many weeks or months. There wouldn't be a lot of surprises. You would have seen all kinds of footage of them elsewhere. Right. You can hear them online instantly for free. So I don't think we'll see that again, do you?
Yeah, I mean, I think in what you're saying, there are two fantastic points. One of them is just that when we think about the media world, I mean, I grew up mostly in the 70s, you know, and even then, you know, if a group like Jethro Tull or Led Zeppelin was coming around, there was no way to really see them on television any other way before that or in films. If you wanted to see that group, you had to get a ticket and go to the show, which, you know, made it a really special event and the kind of thing that, you know, people remember. I mean, you know, can you say to yourself, when was the last, do you remember where you were the first time you saw a One Direction video on YouTube? You know, it doesn't really, because it's so accessible, it doesn't really make that kind of an impact. The second part of what you're saying is has to do with the idea that I'm not sure that, I mean, I think the phenomenon you're talking about still happens in our culture. I'm just not sure it happens in music in the same way. So, for example, if you want to think about a phenomenon that people remember and that sort of seems to, in some way, sort of change their life instantaneously, think about the iPhone. You know, there's something that everybody has to get one. Now they've become sort of integral. We don't know how we lived without it, you know. And so there are things in our world that cause us to cluster around particular events in these kinds of ways. It's just that back in those days, music had the power to be one of those things. And now the map within our culture has changed such that music is no longer in that place anymore, but other things are.
Well, you can see evidence of that in the fact that you just referenced One Direction in a conversation about the Beatles, and my head nearly exploded. But that's okay. No, I think the point is very, very well taken. Looking at the time, we've got time before the half-hour mark to get to a call. Let's get to Robin in Rochester. You're on with Professor John Kovach, who is going to be teaching a class that around the world already 27,000 people have signed up for. And Robin, you're on the line with us this afternoon. Thanks for calling.
Oh, thank you. Yes, seeing Ed Sullivan was, I'm 67, so I was 16 and left a youth group meeting to go home and see the Beatles on the Ed Sullivan Show. But I think more important than that, what the Beatles did for me when I saw Hard Day's Night was I sat in the audience, I was madly in love with George Harrison, and I realized that if I dedicated my life to meeting George Harrison, I probably could, but I would never mean anything to him. And that was like a real sobering moment when I realized that all this screaming and yelling was, you know, a fantasy.
All for naught.
Well, I mean, that brings up I think what you bring up is an important point, which is it's really good, especially for us that do this from a scholarly point of view, it's really good to separate out celebrity from musical importance. I mean, celebrity is something that, you know, really, you know, well, look at the Grammys last night. I mean, there's a show that just, you know, it's all about celebrity from the beginning to the end. It's my opinion only. The music itself is just kind of a vehicle for people to sort of celebrate their celebrity, the celebrity of others, and hope they have a little bit more than everybody else. That sounds cynical, but having spent 35 years in the music business, I gotta say. So that part of it, like you say, sort of recognizing the nature of celebrity is a little bit, you know, sobering, as you say. But then on the other hand, the music is sort of paradoxically also able to touch us in very personal and individual kinds of ways. And it's a paradox because, you know, here are people touching you with things that they've done in music, and this is the way with a lot of art and show business, touching you in individual kinds of ways with something that they've done, but they have no idea who you are, and you haven't really got any idea who they are. But still, somehow through this transmission, this world of art, this world of music, it's possible to make a real connection. It's just not a literal personal connection.
Yeah. Right, and I think that's what the growing moment was for me. I also want to thank you for pushing the Coursera thing, because I think you're absolutely right about people not realizing that the universities offer so much.
That's right.
And even if you're not a student there in today's world, you can definitely partake of a lot of those opportunities.
I mean, in some ways, what we're doing with Coursera is not unlike what people used to do years ago when you did courses over the radio or correspondence courses, except that because it's at a computer and there's video and everybody's sort of into their computer and video right now, it's a way of taking advantage of that moment in our culture to try to get something, to do some kind of good work, you know, intellectually and in terms of the intellectual community.
Hey, Robin, George Harrison later did a song that seemed a little stalker-esque and crazy called Set on You. And I wonder, did you ever meet him, or did you decide against it and you thought better of it?
Oh, no, I realized that, you know, it wasn't worth the effort.
There you go. Well, thank you for the call and for sharing your recollections, Robin. That's great. Thank you very much. You know, we're going to get, wow, the phones are going crazy now. You know why? Because people hear Professor Kovach and they decide, I can't wait to either take this course or hear more from him. So before we get back to the phones, let's start going down the list here, which you've brought the list of the myths of the Beatles' first U.S. visit. Mm-hmm. Again, it was February 9th, 1964. We're coming up on 50 years of their first visit and first appearance on the Ed Sullivan Show. What are some of the myths, Professor?
Well, we're probably up against the clock, and the story of the Ed Sullivan story will take a little bit more time to unfold. So a quick one to dispel is the idea that I Wanna Hold Your Hand was the first Beatles single released by Capitol in North America. The true part of that is it is the first Beatles single to be released by Capitol in the United States. And the story that goes with it is Capitol would not release the earlier Beatles number one hits, She Loves You, From Me to You, and Please Please Me. So the first two of those, Please Please Me and From Me to You, was released by VJ out of Chicago. And She Loves You was released by Swan out of Philadelphia, with an eye, it seems, to trying to get the song on Dick Clark's American Bandstand, because he at one time had a financial interest in Swan Records before the big payola scandal and he had to divest himself. And they did, in fact, get the song onto American Bandstand, where it was rated a 73, therefore a flop. So the story, as far as it goes, is right. They finally got Capitol. The whole story of how Capitol did that is something else again, but they finally got Capitol to release it. But the fact is that Capitol Canada also had the option, and those singles were released on Capitol Canada.
So Canada had it before the United States.
Well, the United States had those records. They were just on VJ or Swan. But Capitol Canada released Please Please Me, and they released From Me to You, and both of them flopped. But She Loves You, when it was released in September, started to become
a
hit.
In Canada.
In Canada, right. And then people started buying the earlier Canadian Canada copies. Now, folks here who are native Rochesterians, it's very possible that some folks in our listening audience have actually got or actually knew of copies on Capitol of things like She Loves You and Please Please Me and From Me to You that actually came across the border from over Buffalo or Ottawa or something.
True or false, it was an American DJ somewhere in the Northwest who broke the rules and played She Loves You, and it was an immediate
hit.
Yeah,
that's not quite right. It was a DJ in Washington, D.C.
Washington, D.C.
A guy by the name of Carol James, who had a copy of I Wanna Hold Your Hand that had been brought over to him in early December by a friend of his, girlfriend, really not quite sure, who was a stewardess for British Airways. And so he was playing it. He was getting a pretty good response. In fact, he'd been recommended to play it by a young listener, one of these sort of AM promotional kind of listener things. I think her name was Marcia Albert, saying, you really should play the Beatles. I think they're fantastic. She'd somehow gotten hold of the Swan copy or the VJ copy or whatever. So as a kind of a promotion, he played it. People started going for it. So he taped it. He only had one copy because it had come over from the UK. So he taped it and sent it to a disc jockey friend of his in Chicago. It started to erupt there. That guy sent a tape to a guy in St. Louis, and it started to erupt there. So Capitol was faced with I Wanna Hold Your Hand, a counterfeit copy, or one that was at least wasn't theirs, starting to sort of erupt on two markets. They originally had scheduled that release of I Wanna Hold Your Hand for mid-January. They called an attorney in New York and tried to have the attorney send the radio station a cease and desist.
Stop playing this music that everybody loves.
But then they kind of figured out, hey, this is stupid. If people want it, let's just move the release date up. So the fact that it was released during Christmas, December the 26th or 27th, 1963.
Christmas week, yeah.
Why in the world would you release a record there? Well, because they wanted product out to take advantage of what they saw as a groundswell of interest in this.
And it worked, didn't it?
It did. By the middle of by the third week of January, I Wanna Hold Your Hand was the number one hit on Cashbox. A week later, it was the number one hit on Billboard. At the time, the Beatles were in France doing a series of theater shows where they were trying to build their French audience and not getting very good reviews. During the day one day, they went in and dubbed the singing to I Wanna Hold Your Hand and She Loves You in German in hopes of building their audience over there. And then the telegram comes and says, you've got a number one in the USA, boys. And of course, that eclipsed anything they were trying to accomplish in France and Germany.
Before we get to a break, let's sneak in one more call. Maggie is on the line. Maggie, go ahead.
Hi. Well, here's another event that makes me feel old. I can hardly believe it's 50 years. Well, I was 23 years old then, so I was beyond the teenage stuff. Elvis was my boy. But anyway, my friends and I watched it that night because we had heard about this great group, and it was fascinating to watch those girls on TV going crazy. We had not quite been able to see all that when Elvis was exciting everyone. But I liked their music, and I even bought myself a little doll. I was in a 5 and 10 one day, and they had these small dolls, almost like large figurines, each one of the Beatles you could buy, and they were sort of like bobblehead dolls. Their heads bobbed up and down, and that's how they were when they were performing, if you remember. Their heads were always moving around. So I had this little doll, and I put it on my dashboard of my car. But I wanted to relate it to the Kennedy assassination, too, because that had just occurred 3 months before. And I had gone down to Washington for the funeral. And everybody I knew was so sad about this. And when the Beatles thing all started, I thought to myself, well, maybe we're getting back to normal now because we can do this and we aren't all in mourning anymore.
That's an interesting take, and, mm-hmm. and one I hadn't heard. And Professor, for those who say, but it's just music, to your point, there's a power there, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, part of what the Kennedy presidency had been about was youth and optimism, and so to have lost him was certainly a terrible blow, in more than just a political sense for those who were involved in his supported his policies, but for the whole sort of image of self-image of America. So, what America needed was a diversion. And what's interesting is that the first television exposure that the Beatles got, as you mentioned at the top of the hour, was a short thing that Walter Cronkite did on the CBS News with Walter Cronkite, right? The regular sort of dinner time report that he did that everybody would tune into because Walter Cronkite was, of course, America's anchor man at the time. This was only a couple of weeks after all of this happened with Kennedy. And then, of course, there's the story that you mentioned about Jack Parr playing a bit of the Beatles on The Tonight Show in January, and then, of course, Ed Sullivan in February. So when we think about Walter Cronkite, the guy who gave many people the news of the death of President Kennedy, sort of a couple weeks later doing the Beatles, people will argue about whether or not the Beatles thing happened out of a kind of out of the grief of the Kennedy mm-hmm. assassination. But certainly the idea of going to a story like that during a time when the news had been kind of down, and a fun kind of story about these kooky kids in England and how they were acting so goofy over this group named after an insect, seemed like the kind of, 5 minutes before the end of the show kind of fluff piece that you might do to kind of put a smile on people's faces. And so that was really the first exposure that people had to the Beatles. Who knew? It would lead to something as big as it was.
All right, here's a little to-do list because we're late for the shortest break in radio, but we've got a packed second half hour coming up. When we come back, we're going to get to Mike in Rochester. You're on the line. We're going to get to Mike next. We're going to hear more from their appearance on the Ed Sullivan Show. We're going to tell you what else the U of R is doing because the University of Rochester has a lot planned coming up in conjunction with this 50th anniversary. And we've got the professor in studio for the hour, Professor John Kovach, who, if you wanted to take that online class that starts the night of the 50th anniversary, February 9th at 8 p.m., you can sign up on
Coursera.
Coursera. Right. So it's all coming up here. You're listening to member-supported public radio, AM 1370 and FM 91.5, HD2 Rochester.
Philomena continues this week at The Little, based on the 2009 investigative book by the BBC correspondent Martin Sixsmith, The Lost Child of Philomena Lee. The film focuses on the efforts of Philomena Lee, mother to a boy conceived out of wedlock, something her Irish Catholic community did not have the highest opinion of, and given away for adoption in the United States. In the following church doctrine, she was forced to sign a contract that wouldn't allow for any sort of inquiry into the son's whereabouts. Learn more at thelittle.org.
And welcome back to Connections. I always promise it's the shortest break in radio.
There
and
you
it,
go.
And it really is. We've got Professor John Kovach here. Let's first get to Mike in Rochester, who's been waiting to weigh in. Go ahead, Mike.
Yes, Doctor, this melding of history is really important. You mentioned the Beatles as a British invasion. But since we're celebrating the War of 1812, you really have to associate the British invasion of the Beatles as a culmination of British and American history
right.
coming together. And you have to really focus on Liverpool. They came from Liverpool,
right.
and Liverpool was the port where most of the Irish immigration came from. And there's also a big slave trade
right.
location. So, I mean, there's sort of a continuity of British history with American melding. And, as a historian myself, I see it as a very important. The Beatles legend is going to grow,
right?
And they're going to be like a Bach or a Beethoven in time to come.
Well, I mean, I think we already think of their music as being one of the best representatives of popular music in the 20th century. So in many ways, they've already sort of reached the canon. You know, they've become part of the canon of popular music. You know, but you talk about the political and international connections between America and Britain. Probably the most important one for music historians is the fact that with the Second World War, so many Americans were in the UK in the 1940s and brought their popular music and their popular culture with them. And so they created a tremendous love for American popular music and the idea of America being the place of opportunity and all that in the UK. And so when the Beatles were growing up, they were hearing a lot predominantly American popular music. One of the points I make in teaching my classes, really, those first couple years of Beatles music is, for all intents and purposes, American popular music with a British accent. Now, the British accent is notable and attractive and gives it a kind of a distinction. And of course, there's Beatles in the middle of it too. But still, if you look at the music from the way it's put together, the way it's produced and all that, for all intents and purposes, they're really doing American pop.
And if I could weigh in here, Mike, hang in there, because I'm going to make a comparison that I don't think is a stretch. Mike brought up the way we think about Beethoven.
Right.
Will we eventually think of the Beatles the same way? Here's a comparison that immediately came to mind for me. When Beethoven started doing symphonies, he grew to hate his first symphony. He thought it was his simplest, his most commercially accessible, his most poppy at the time. It's strange to think of symphony music that way, but he thought it was his simplest and most dumbed down. It was also his most popular for many years until the ninth. And so the one that was some of the most popular was the one that he liked the least. And then, of course, he grew to create much more complex and interesting music. The Beatles come out with this poppy stuff that got them very, very popular.
Right.
But then they went on to create what I thought was much more interesting
significant
music. So I don't know if that makes sense as a comparison, but I do think that might be the way we look back at them.
Well, one of the storylines in the way that I tell the Beatles the story of their development is what I call from craftsmen to artists. And that is they begin wanting to do nothing more than brill-building composers were doing in the early 1960s, which is to write songs, to sell records, to really be popular, but to do it in a way that had a kind of an integrity from a craft point of view. That is, do it, but do it well. But no pretense to saying something important or writing music that would last a lifetime or whatever. But as they continue to develop, starting in 64, you can already see it, and then into 65 and 66 with Rubber Soul, Revolver, and finally Sgt. Pepper, you see them increasingly turning to what we would call the artist model, which is the idea of trying to do something not the same way a second time, always making some new contribution, trying to say something important, trying to push the envelope. One of the great accomplishments, I think, of the Beatles is they took all of that pop commercial success and reinvested it in freedom in the studio to be able to push the boundaries of rock music further and further in terms of musical ambition. A lot of people would have just taken the money and redid the same thing over and over again.
Most do.
Well,
most don't change and evolve and make that kind of contribution, don't you think, Professor?
Well, that's what I mean. So in a certain sense, you can see a progression away from the idea that every song should be well-crafted. I mean, think about the way somebody makes a table. If you make a table and you're a fine craftsman, once you figure out how to make that table in a way that has all kinds of structural integrity and beauty and all those kinds of things, you tend to make it the same way over and over again. There's no embarrassment in that. There's no sort of weakness. But if somebody's Beethoven and they're writing a symphony, if they write a second symphony that sounds like the first symphony, everybody says, he's just written the same piece again. And it really is a show of weakness and lack of creativity. For the Beatles, it was increasingly a movement from making tables to making symphonies, if you want to put it that way.
Well, it was a great call from Mike there. And before we get to more of the professor's debunking of some of the myths around that first appearance on the Ed Sullivan Show, I want to run down some of what the University of Rochester is doing. Once again, February 9th, 8 p.m., the Coursera, the free course on the Beatles that Professor Kovach is teaching. He's the director of the Institute for Popular Music. It is a free course online, and 27,000 people have already signed up. You can do that as well by going to Coursera online and doing that. But also coming up, February 5th, 7 p.m., there's a lecture with Andy, I think it's Babiak, and Andy is talking about the Beatles and their gear. What was the gear they brought?
Right. But Andy is a local guy, but international by reputation. He's got a couple of books, Beatles Gear and Stones Gear, and he is meticulously going through and figured out exactly which guitars, amps, and drums the groups used at various stages of their career. He's a fascinating guy, and it's an authoritative study.
Coming up on February 9th at 7 p.m., also free, it's a lecture from Walter Everett from the University of Michigan.
Now, Walt's on at 2 p.m.
I'm sorry, 2 p.m.
2 p.m.
I'm just not reading well.
Right,
that's
right.
My fault.
But Walt Everett has written a couple of books on the Beatles called The Beatles as Musicians for Oxford University Press, and Walt is just absolutely, these are the best books. If you care about the musical end of how the Beatles songs worked, Walt's two books are just absolute required reading. So he's going to be here talking to us. That's right, that Sunday at 2.
Sunday at 2. And Sunday the 9th at 8 p.m., the 50th anniversary celebration concert,
right,
with the Smooth Talkers.
That's right. Tape the Grammy celebration. Put it on your, because that way, you can then fast forward through all the silly commercials and watch it sometime later and gain some time back in your life. And come out and see the Smooth Talkers along with the faculty and students of the University of Rochester Music Department performing a music in celebration of the Beatles. It's just great to play this music. It's great to get the students up there singing and performing along with the group. I think you'll have a fantastic time. We're going to just do the very best we can to put on the very best Beatles celebration there in Strong Auditorium. A whole team of people are working together to put on a very special event. Absolutely free of charge.
Free.
I can't do anything about the parking, but people can get in for free.
And where is it?
It's in Strong Auditorium, University of Rochester River Campus.
All right. There you go, 8 p.m., free. Look at all these free events. So let's go back and let's listen to the Ed Sullivan Show. This is later in that first night. We're going to listen to Mr. Sullivan, and boy, you could tell Ed really knew that the world was watching him. So let's listen to some more.
You know, something very nice happened, and the Beatles got a great kick out of it. Just received a wire, they did, from Elvis Presley and Colonel Tom Parker, wishing them a tremendous success in our country. I think that was very, very nice. Introducing the Beatles again, may I point out that they'll be on our show, as I told our audience, for the next two Sundays. Next Sunday from Deauville Hotel in the Miami Beach show, starring Hollywood's exciting Mitzi Gaynor. But ladies and gentlemen, once again...
So there they are, and that screaming. I can't tell if Ed Sullivan was trying to say more, and the audience screaming just drowned him out there, John.
Well, I don't know. I think Ed was having the night of his life. I mean, when you host a show and you've got half the country tuning in, I think that more than half of the televisions in use that night were tuned in, at least for the Beatles parts. I mean, how can you not love that?
20-some million households, yeah. More than 70 million viewers. But the story of how they ended up on his show and what he did is, it gets sort of convoluted. If you
That's
go to
right.
different sources online, they all sort of tell you different things. What do we know and what is sort
well,
of murky?
I mean, I start out by saying we have to be easy on the music journalists and Beatles historians who've put this information together because, they don't have a lot of original materials, original records and things to work from. So they're all doing their very best. But a number of these myths have sprung up. And so if you've read a bunch of the books, you probably have read these myths as if they were correct and authoritative. The first thing is that the Ed Sullivan performance, The Beatles Coming to America, was engineered primarily by a guy by the name of Sid Bernstein. Sid was a talent agent working at... an agency in New York, but who also had a real penchant for British culture. And so he would go into Times Square and buy the British newspapers and sort of keep up on what was going on. Well, he starts to see about this Beatles group very early, in early 1963. He contacts Brian Epstein in Liverpool. At this point, the Beatles are just starting, they've just had their first big hit with Please Please Me in That Country. Brian is still living at home in his family house. Sid Bernstein liked to tell the story of his mother answering the phone and saying, Brian, and hearing him sort of the footsteps as he came down the steps, is I'd like to bring your group to America. And Brian says, well, that's fantastic, but, why would you want to do that? We're not getting any airplay or selling any records there. And he says, yes, but I think you will. Your group is fantastic. At this point, Sid Bernstein had not heard the Beatles, but just read about them in British papers and British reports. And so in order to impress Brian, he said, I'll give you $6,500 for two performances. Where would you like us to perform? America's premier concert hall, Carnegie Hall. Well, Brian, being an artsy type, he knew that Carnegie Hall was great stuff. He said, well, this sounds great. When do you want to do it? Well, we could do it in 3 months. Oh, no, no, that's too soon. We're not selling any records. Okay, well, let's say 1964, about a year from now, because the phone call was probably in March. He chose February the 12th, which was Lincoln's birthday, which all the kids got off from school. Perfect day to get Carnegie Hall. It wasn't a Friday or Saturday when there would be a classical concert there. So he gets the hall, and so they know February 12th is there. In the meantime, Ed Sullivan in September is doing his vacationing around Europe, and he had a guy who was his sort of London talent scout fellow. And so Ed had met with this guy, and he told him a bit about the Beatles. And then Ed came back to this country and was getting sent press clippings that talked all about the Beatles. First, they did this Sunday night at the London Palladium show in October, which sort of launched Beatlemania.
Which was kind of the British version of the Ed Sullivan show?
That's right. And then the Royal Command performance in November. So by then, this talent agent was, this London guy was sending Ed all this stuff saying, I think you really ought to sort of go just do what you can do. Well, he put Brian Epstein in charge with, in touch with Ed's people, and Brian Epstein himself came in the second week of November to this country to meet with Ed Sullivan and put these gigs together. But mostly he came to this country to try to promote Billy J. Kramer, one of his newest acts along with the Beatles. Well, they worked out a time to get the Beatles to perform. He exchanged a certain amount of fee. In other words, the Beatles were paid less to be higher on the bill. Brian really wanted them to be the headliners.
The lead, yeah.
It turns out that actually, in terms of the technical billing, they weren't. Although by the time the show came around, everybody
they
felt
sure
like
were,
they
yeah,
were.
Yeah.
And so since they were already going to be here February the 12th, they figured out that would be February the 9th. And one of Ed's assistants said, well, look, if we're going to pay for their airfare and everything, we should get more than one show out of these guys. So they got them there February the 9th. Then they took them down to Miami to do the show that Ed mentioned in that clip. And then they taped a third performance that ran the week after that. So they were on TV 3 weeks in a row. And so in many ways, it's clear that Ed Sullivan was not at that airport and was not there when this incident occurred when the Beatles were coming back from Sweden. This is revealed in a biography of Ed Sullivan by a guy who's sort of done all the homework on this. But
did Ed tell that story? How did that get out?
He told that story.
Yeah.
He told it against like David Sarnoff having been there when the Titanic was going down. It's one of these kinds of stories that you tell because you're a showman and it's a great story and people like to hear it.
Gotcha.
There was in fact a time that event did occur. It's just that Ed wasn't there. Ed had been at Heathrow Airport, but that was in September, not November.
Not
October the
31st. Not October 31st, when the Beatles did arrive back.
But it was a great story, and you're in show business, and a story is a great thing, and people are always asking. So he sort of told that story, but it's pretty clear that it really wasn't that way. So you got to give a lot of props to Sid Bernstein for that. And then, one of the other myths that comes up is that the Beatles' performance on Ed Sullivan was the first one on television. And like we said a little bit earlier, in fact, they'd been on Walter Cronkite, they'd been on the evening news, and they'd been on Jack Parr. But then when a hard
but not
day,
live.
That's right. That's right. And in fact, it's often said that the Washington, D.C. concert, which occurred on February the 11th, was the Beatles' first live concert. Now, you have to say live concert because they'd already done the live performance on Ed Sullivan. Then they went to D.C. At first, Brian booked that because he wanted them to have an out-of-town gig to do a show before they came back to do the two Carnegie Hall shows. And because Washington had blown up with the Beatles initially, they thought, well, that would be a pretty favorable crowd. And so the people, General Artists Corporation, sort of worked that gig out for them. Then it turned into CBS wanted to film that concert, which is supposed to be the warm-up concert, and was actually broadcast in theaters in March after the Beatles were on Ed Sullivan. So the idea that A Hard Day's Night is the Beatles' first film is not entirely correct either. So they did February 9, February 11 in Washington, big snowstorm, couldn't fly, but Brian went to his own expense to have an extra car hooked up to the express train to take everybody down there. Why would he spend all that money? In fact, Brian Epstein, by most accounts, went out of pocket
on that first Beatles trip to the U.S. He didn't make enough money to cover all the expenses. He went into his family fortune a little bit, but it was a fantastic investment, of course, because
it paid off a ton.
So all of these things, they're tough to untangle, but if you look into it, it's amazing how much all of this happened in a kind of common sense music business kind of way. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was a fantastic conversion of events. I mean, to have a hit record by a new group on the charts at number one, just at about the time you're showing up to play one of the biggest variety shows on television. I mean, you can't plan that.
No.
It just kind of happens. People have tried many, many times and failed. It fell in for them. And what's interesting is they had the talent to back it up. And when they hit so big, they had so much unreleased material. Or material that had been released but hadn't sold very well, that they had to hold off bringing out any new material until the summer of 64, because all of these records from 1963 that had been hits in the U.S., in the U.K., and other album tracks were all of a sudden up in April of 1964. The Beatles had the top five singles in the United States on two different labels. So, I mean, three different labels even. So it's fantastic, the success that they had, but they were ready for it. You know, that's the recipe. It's one thing to get an opportunity. It's a second thing that when the opportunity comes, to be ready to capitalize on it, and they did like crazy.
The director of the Institute for Popular Music, Professor John Kovach, is here in studio from the University of Rochester, getting ready to teach his course on the Beatles, a six-week free online course that only 27,000 people have signed up for via Coursera. If you look up Coursera online and check out Beatles, you will find his course. It launches February 9th, 8 p.m., the same time, 50 years on, that the Beatles were on the Ed Sullivan Show for the first time. Let's get to Beth in Rochester. Beth, you're on with Professor Kovach.
Yes, I remember the Beatles becoming popular around 1964, and I did happen to see them in Toronto a few years later. I was lucky enough to get a ticket. It was sort of meant for my younger cousin, but I remember the screaming. I'll never remember the noise. It was quite remarkable. And then I graduated high school in 1966, and the boys are starting to wear their hair a little bit longer, kind of gradually. And there was one boy in my class, he had a little bit of bushy hair up front. They wouldn't even let him graduate high school back then, which was quite unfortunate. But because it wasn't that long, I think a few years later, the boys were wearing their hair even longer.
The Beatles affect in the hairstyle, Professor.
Absolutely.
They affected everything, didn't they?
Do you remember that summer of 66 on that tour? Do you remember the Beatles Are Bigger Than Jesus controversy?
Beatles Are Bigger Than Jesus.
Yeah.
No, what was the controversy?
Well, I was just asking the caller whether she remembers that being a part of this situation. But yeah, I mean, this is really the turning point from when the Beatles stopped becoming a kind of a pop boy band of a certain kind, you know, and started to become sort of a hippie group for all intents and purposes in the moments just before FM rock sort of FM radio sort of took over, but probably by the summer of 67 into 68 that FM radio took over and the Beatles started to become much more of an FM group. Think about the White Album and that kind of thing. But at this point, John had said in an interview done in the UK that if there was what he thought about the controversy, a lot of people were saying that pop music turned kids to the devil, this kind of thing. What he thought about religion. He said, well, all I can tell you is if there was a church service on one side of the street and a Beatles concert on the other side of the street, there'd be more kids at the Beatles service and at the Beatles concert. And you know, he's basically trying to say that he thought the Beatles were, you know, more popular with kids, and that maybe wasn't a good thing. But the way it played especially in the American South, was Beatle John says Beatles bigger than Jesus, and it caused Beatle burnings, which was great because then they bought those records again. But it caused such a fuss. We were talking about the Kennedy assassination before, that the Beatles had death threats, and they had the security in those days was so minor, I mean, in terms of being able to protect them, that anybody could have taken a shot at any of the Beatles. And they knew that all through that 66 tour. Every time somebody would set off a firecracker or something, they would all look around to see if anybody had been shot. There was actually somebody in Canada who said they were going to take a shot at Ringo, and so they actually had a policeman sitting on the drum riser as they performed. And Ringo liked to tell the story. He says, well, what's this guy actually going to do if somebody takes a shot at me? Catch the bullets or something? But he did arrange the cymbals, so they were a little bit more vertical.
Angled, blocking, yes. Yeah. Let's get to Buffalo. Joe in Buffalo is calling. Go ahead, Joe.
Yeah, hi. Just a little bit of trivia regarding the Beatles' first live show after the Ed Sullivan appearance. There's a station here, WKBW, back in the 60s, was huge for nationwide for rock and roll acts. George Hound Dog Lorenzo is one of the disc jockeys and so forth. They were very well known for, you know, pioneering rock music. And they were offered this DJ, I don't know if you've heard him, Dan Nevereth, was huge back in the 60s, 70s, 80s. Offered the Beatles' first show the night after the Ed Sullivan show.
Right.
And I think it was $3,500 is what the Beatles wanted for the Memorial Auditorium. Right. And KB turned it down, thinking it was a Monday night in Buffalo in the winter, and they would probably lose money on the deal and get a lot of empty seats. And I guess to this day, they regret it. They could have been the scene of that first film and the first Beatles concert and you know, after Ed Sullivan. So I just thought I'd
Right. I mean, when the agent had to book it, I mean, it was a matter of calling around and sort of finding who wanted to take the show and take a risk on the show. In fact, the guy who ended up doing it at the Washington Coliseum ended up putting three other acts on the bill, Tommy Rowe being one of them, the Chiffons, I think, being another one. I have this written. This, of course, is all published on the Internet. You can find out. But that happened because that guy was afraid he was going to lose his shirt on this relatively, what he thought was a relatively unknown group, the Beatles. So it turned out everybody was there to see the Beatles. And this was, again, in the middle of a big snowstorm, but people showed up. It was a fantastic night. But, yeah, there were probably half a dozen of places that were offered that show and turned it down. That's how it ended up in D.C.
Joe, thanks for the recollections there. We appreciate it, and it's been a fun hour here. Are you looking forward to the course, Professor?
I am. I think it's going to be great, and I really hope people, you know, just taking the course doesn't mean you have to commit to all of it. The videos are there, and you can just watch the fun ones or your favorite ones or just dip in now and again. Being a part of the course doesn't mean you have to make a time commitment, really. You can just, you don't have to take the course for the certificate. You can just watch the videos and just watch the ones that interest you.
Isn't free education and frankly, adult learning, I mean, it's that's what the Internet is allowed us to do around the world and connect with each other. Yeah. I think it's great.
It's fantastic. I hope as many of you who are listening will sign up and check out the videos and post on the comments boards and all that goes on there and just join the fun. I think it's going to be great.
Professor John Kovach is the director of the Institute for Popular Music, among half a dozen other titles or so at the University of Rochester. It's been great stuff. I appreciate it. Best Beatles album, Professor, you're on the spot.
I'll take A Hard Day's Night.
I'll take Sgt. Pepper. We'll agree to disagree.
And we'll listen to them both later today.
Well, there you go. There you go. The Ed Sullivan stuff was fun, but I think it's really amazing, as you pointed out so well, how much they did over the next 6 years. It feels like two decades worth of work. And it was 6 years later that they broke up. Just really, really amazing stuff. Been fun to have you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And check out the University of Rochester's website, because a lot more coming up as they celebrate the Beatles' 50th anniversary. That's on February 50th anniversary on the Ed Sullivan Show, I should say, on February 9th. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a great day. We'll see you tomorrow.